Chapter 6 West Archives. Refitting the Hejastro to be able to transport the granite box took the better part of 2 weeks. Keeping quiet about the fact that the box existed in the first place lasted about 2 hours. Then, of course, there was the inevitable disagreement about where the object would be located and who would have access to it, and on and on. This was a distraction that John wanted nothing to do with, except he was right in the middle of it. It was finally agreed upon that the first of the boxes found would be located at the new lunar site under development. Teams from around the world would be given the opportunity to do their own investigation, and if anybody wanted to share their findings, then so much the better. There was one stipulation that really did not take much convincing. John insisted that the final resting spot of the first box would be at Weiss Harbor, an honor that did not occur for several years. John had finally conceded, and the manufacturing expertise of first the U.S. and then the rest of the world was brought to bear on the problems being encountered by his team and by the need for new and creative construction techniques. An agreement was reached between the two parties, and a 115-megawatt nuclear reactor was ordered and under construction. Because of the way in which the vessel itself was to be constructed, naval engineers were brought in to design a skin that would eventually resemble a submarine without the conning tower, pointed nose, or drive shafts. It was closer to a pipe with four symmetrical bulges running almost the length, then tapering off near the ends. This was a completely different monster compared to the skiffs built so far. The design was intended for all the work to be done along the central core, and the personnel, fuel, and supplies to be external to the work. On the previous models, the thrust unit was in the back, pointed aft, the generator being forward of the thrust unit, and the step drive was forward of it. Then came the crew area with the fuel surrounding everything and the magnetic compression coils external to the hull. With this design, the reactor was central. A generator on either side provided the primary and backup electrical power. On either side of the generator were a step 3 drive unit and finally the thrust units. So there was a backup to everything but the reactor itself. Military experience had proven the reliability of the reactor that was to be installed, and the ship was not going to be going outside the solar system without a thorough shakedown of all the systems. During this phase of construction, Sarah and Marty began a long and involved series of military training schools. For Marty, he had his job cut out for him as he attempted to mold the Space Force into a viable community of people dedicated to the idea of following his lead. For Sarah, it was more the need to understand and develop the techniques that would be required to integrate civilian and military personnel. This mixing was inevitable and would become apparent even on this first vessel. The reactor and subsystems were not going to take care of themselves, and it was going to require a coordinated effort on everyone's part to forge this new breed of sailor. Naval submariners were already adapted to the type of living condition that West anticipated for the crew of the up-and-coming ships. Long stretches of incarceration in an enclosed space. Getting the right type of person would require more than just a simple background check. These people would need to be able to live, laugh, and suffer together while at the same time not losing their cool. The crew that had built the moon stations and started building the Mars outposts were the best that Western Wave had to offer for taking on such a task, but the experience would be different and the environment unrelatable. Sarah's job in the short term was to learn about the systems that were going to be installed in the latest ships. With the help of the military, mock simulations were designed and built so that the people could get a good feel for the realities to come. She then pulled double duty twice a week at a military hospital and several nearby clinics to keep her rating up and to see for herself what kind of advancements were available for deployment. "Any ship I work on is going to be ready to handle anything," she told herself once more. The push to get to Alpha Centauri was not going to be a straightforward shot. It was going to consist of well-defined steps establishing a series of supply depots along the flight path. Each of these stations were going to be small drop points designed to provide aid and a sense of security to the wayward travelers. Each station would need to be placed in the correct location with the correct velocity vector applied, so the two systems and the drop points maintained a reasonably straight path. This supply line would need to be adjusted periodically, but if it did not somehow change dramatically, it would be beneficial. A lot of work had also been being dumped into the developing a small plutonium power source, which could create the wattage necessary for the thermal generator used to power the step relay repeater. If the radio only meant to reach the first step, the power requirements would have been quite small, but the idea was to bite the bullet and provide the necessary power to oscillate through the third step. The nice thing about the power source was that, like with the nuclear reactor that would power the ship, these small power plants never needed refueling, at least not during the expected life cycle. The plan was to construct one at a time and deploy a relay at each of the depots for redundancy, though it was still a mystery what kind of distance could be achieved with one relay station. Rachel was busy supervising the Mars One installation, along with coordinating the personnel movement between Earth, the Moon, and Mars. She was juggling a lot, and several people had been brought in to fill vital gaps in the workload. The problem was that she felt it her responsibility to ensure that all the pieces were fitting together, and it was taking its toll. Fortunately, the ship's construction was completely out of her hands, so she could concentrate on getting the Mars base to a point where real work could be done. To date, the first shaft had been dug over halfway down to the best of 14 caverns discovered so far. They were all different sizes and depths, but the effort was concentrated on the closest one to the top, which also appeared to be the largest. The cavern was going to be a real test of logistics and engineering. Teams were developing new techniques to make the caverns work, depending on the type of structure encountered. It was not all guesswork, though. Core samples had already established that the surrounding rock was extremely hard, but this made it difficult to excavate the size that would allow for an elevator shaft to connect the surface to the required depth. The plan was, once the hole was dug, a second shaft would be cut on the horizontal, out the side of the Olympus Mons, with a path to lead back to the top. This was going to be the easy part, as the distance was only a few hundred feet. Once inside, the interior would be reshaped quickly, and a layer of sealant sprayed over the surface. When dried, the cavern would support an atmosphere, and the living conditions on Mars would begin to improve significantly. But it all cost money, and Western Wave was only generating so much. Rachel and her father had several arguments regarding the expenditures. She maintained the fact that if he wanted to get everything working, he needed more ships to move more people and equipment. The backlog was significant, and Rachel was pushing her dad to build more drives. Two large skiffs were finished and only needed one thing to make them operational. "Dad, you need to put a Step 3 in the Hijastro so we can keep up. We are way behind, and NASA just put two more sections of the sub in low Earth orbit." The sub was Rachel's pet name for the ship being built to go interstellar. "We need to get them to Mars so the assembly team doesn't fall behind." Rachel was mad, and it showed. "You have way too many irons in the fire, and we need more and faster ships. You have to concentrate on that for now."
"Look, Rachel, I am not running a Step 3 in a cargo ship until the avoidance software works, and Shannon hasn't proven that to me yet."
"Then show somebody else how to build those damn drives of yours so we can get more ships working," she said in exasperation.
"Nope, that's not going to happen," John said defensively. "Look, sweetheart, I'll work on the drives for the other skiffs, okay? It's going to take time to get them out, though." Rachel threw up her hands and walked out of the shop. John half skipped, half walked up behind her.
"Rachel," touching her shoulder, she stopped and turned around to face him. "I know this is a trying period, and I'm sorry. I will work on the skiffs and get them out."
"Where are we with finances?" he asked in earnest.
"We're short, Dad. That's the whole point. We cannot keep going like this. We have a lot of stuff getting manufactured by a lot of people who are a hell of a lot better at it than us, and we are getting outpaced fast. On top of that, we have a lot of paying customers who we cannot accommodate because we either have other things going on or the work they want done requires too many resources. I needed those two skiffs up and running yesterday, and you keep breaking the step three drives and building new ones with nobody covering our butts by building the drives we know work.
Okay, look, I've not been exactly truthful about the situation. The step three isn't broken. It's under review after taking that last hit. There's a backup step two in the test bed. How about I get Anne and Trevor to install that unit in one of the skiffs, and I will certify the step three for use in the second skiff to be rated for step two only. Both ships could be ready for trials in less than a week.
What?
She looked at him in disbelief.
Yeah, if you can do that, then please do.
She was even more pissed now. Rachel, you need to show me the itinerary you're working with. I'm going to need to slow some of the work getting done. You are going to have a breakdown at this rate. How about we get together after supper and go over how best to keep things flowing smoothly, okay?
Fine,
she stated with annoyance, already contacting Anne about moving the drives. West Archives. John's time off to catch up on regular chores had started out well enough. He was not being badgered, and for the most part, people were generally leaving him alone. There were, however, several nagging issues that needed addressing, and he had been called to Washington to get a handle on them. If he could get the approval he needed for the next ship, that would be a big score. He had originally planned on the reactor to be moved from the sub and put into the next generation vessel. Now he was trying to convince the government of the merits of allowing him a second reactor, providing the means to construct two of the larger vessels, meant to house the Step 4 drive, if he ever figured out how to build it, that is. These trips to the White House were becoming way too frequent. There was just no one else who was going to be able to sit in front of the assembled audience and requisition the outrageous list of items that his company needed. Everyone knew what his drive was capable of, and seeing how far it could go was certainly in the back of each person's mind. However, the sentiment held by most was, sure, build your interstellar ship, but we are more interested in what can be done closer to home. The excitement about exploring our solar system had every scientific community on Earth chomping at the bit to be given access to a vessel. They were more than willing to make the arrangements to have all the supplies and personnel picked and packaged and ready to go. The backlog was significant, and Rachel was doing her best to accommodate the requests. Not only did it involve getting the groups to their destination, but then there was the inevitable need to watch over them, and finally, transport back to the bridge. A formidable job, but one that Rachel's team was committed to. It was the lack of drives that concerned her the most, and the list of paying customers were not getting any smaller. She knew that at some point the gravy train was going to stop. Someone else was going to figure out the step drive, and Western Wave was going to be left in the dust, especially if the drive information were turned over to a powerful country to manufacture. This nagging thought bugged the hell out of her.
Dad is so stubborn keeping this design secret that the company he has built will be crushed by its first competitor, an argument she had voiced to her father on a regular basis.
Then, of course, there was the political factions that wanted this new industry heavily regulated, and it was an election year. The current administration was to be supplanted in about 10 months' time, and any favor John had curried from the existing political structure might change in a significant way very soon. He needed to act quickly if the support he enjoyed had any chance of surviving.
If I can just get that second reactor purchased, he thought to himself, as he once again sat at the end of a long conference table looking at the assembled group.
This room had become part of his life now. It was always the same surroundings, just the people who changed. But today sat a group he had dealt with before.
Mr. West, the vice president held up one hand in protest. You have made remarkable progress to date, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Why the urgency to purchase this second reactor when you yourself have stated several times to this committee that you still do not know how to construct the next level drive unit? It seems premature to move forward without ever having solved one of the key issues you've currently faced. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Madam Vice President, John admitted. I have not solved the problem surrounding the Step 4 drive, but I am confident the energy requirements that will be needed by the drive are sound. Until the issue are overcome, a comparable drive to the one under construction at Mars can be built and utilized to ferry around the ever-growing list of scientific explorers to their destinations. John's argument was falling on deaf ears, and he knew it. The VP was going to be the likely presidential nominee for the party, and with her popularity, would soon be the new president. And that leads me to my next point, Mr. West. Vice President Capshaw paused for effect. Why the need for the Mars base when it would be a lot more efficient to work from Earth? The ships could be parked in orbit, loaded, refueled, and the destinations, as you call them, could be doled out by a blue ribbon scientific panel who could determine which projects to fund. Not this hodgepodge of plans quickly thrown together and then put in a queue that only you can fulfill. It's a very disorganized way to allocate resources. Do you understand what I mean? John understood. She was the main reason that he was driving so hard to get the second reactor. If she has her way, John and his company will not be leaving the solar system on her watch. Cooperation from her administration would probably require letting her physicists get their hands on his technology. Susan Campshaw's stance on his secrecy was well known to most, and it did not bode well for John West having a cozy relationship with the U.S. government after she becomes president. It wasn't a one-way street by any means. She understood that there were governments who were already voicing their support for the cause. They were willing to supply him with the necessary equipment to make it happen, if given a seat at the table, and due credit. John was not to this point yet, for his loyalties lie with his home, and he wanted to keep it that way. It was a matter of negotiating the roadblocks in front of him. I'm too old for this, he told himself. It was not the way he wanted to be spending his vacation. The president's aide stepped in, handed him a phone, and whispered in his ear. The president looked at John and said, "It's your daughter, Rachel." He pressed the key to take the call and put it on speaker. John was busy waving his hands and indicating that he was not there, much to the astonishment of all in attendance. "Rachel, this is the president. I do not remember you ever calling me directly before. What's up?" His voice was light and even, almost happy for a break in the meeting. "Mr. President, I'm sorry to bother you, but do you know where my dad is?" Her voice indicated something was wrong, and she was worried. West was still indicating his absence, and the president decided that he was avoiding her for a reason. The questioning look combined with the palms up told everyone that he did want to know what the problem was. The president slowly accepted his role. "We can certainly locate him for you, but it may take some time. What's wrong?" "Dad's phone appears to be off, and I really need him. We have a ship in trouble, and nobody knows what to do." Her voice cracked at this last word. The rotating hand suggested John wanted more info. A confused president started wanting her father to answer the damn phone, but finally decided to play along for a bit. "Walk me through it, Rachel. We have a lot of smart people in this room right now. Maybe we can help." "I don't see how," she said, sounding a bit annoyed. Then continued. "Sarah has been testing out Shanna's new avoidance software in the Hajastro, and a few of them decided to try something today. They attempted to put out one of the step relays I got delivered last week."
"Yes," the president replied. "We were told by your father that this software was a major hurdle and that it was being tested."
"And we are aware of the step relay that got delivered and the testing of the units. So you're telling me they went off script and are somewhere they shouldn't be? Is that about right?"
"Yes." Her voice cracked in fear again. They went out about 300 AU astronomical units along the Alpha Centauri planned path, and now they can't come back.
The president was out of his depth, so he threw out the question. What is an AU? His science advisor piped up at this point, hardly believing what he had just heard.
Mr. President, 1 AU is the distance the Earth is from the sun. Approximately 8.3 light minutes. Rachel just indicated to us that they are over 300 times farther away from the sun than the Earth is.
Jack Terrence slowly swung his head around to look at West, who was sitting there, eyes closed, slowly shaking his head.
Rachel, you say they can't get back. What do you mean by that? Asked the president.
Once they deployed the relay, they turned around to come back, but every time they move in step space, they go in the wrong direction. It's always the same direction, but it's always away from Earth and away from our solar system. They have tried a lot of things to stop it from happening, but it's not working. I'm scared.
John was already drawing on the dry erase board that covered the wall behind where he sat. The first word he had written was provisions, and the president was getting a clue how John wanted this to play out. He was not always going to be around, and some of these problems were going to have to be sorted out without his help.
Okay, that seems smart, he thought.
Rachel, let's slow down just a bit and evaluate. What kind of provisions does that ship have? 1 hour? 1 day? 1 week? What?
There are 4 people on the Hijastro with food and air for 5 days, and fuel to last 15 days.
Okay, 5 days then, said the president. We have a little time on our side.
The president was looking over the drawing that John had started and began to recognize what he was seeing. He also understood the words, Hijastro not rated for interstellar space.
Rachel, are you aware that your father never rated that ship for interstellar travel?
Yes, we all did, but it was thought that it just couldn't go travel to the next star system or something. I don't know.
Well, I believe it wasn't rated for interstellar travel because of the Birkeland current that flows out beyond our solar system.
Yeah, he said that, but what does it even mean? Sarah and Shannon seemed to understand it, but only after things started to go wrong. Dad says the entire solar system is powered by Birkeland currents. Why should this be any different?
The picture on the wall showed the solar system, the heliopause, and what looked like flowing streams around the heliopause, with disrupted streams inside the solar system. The picture also showed the Earth and a much stronger set of streams moving along its axis. This was all beginning to make sense to him. He had heard John explain the electric universe model to him several times, but until now, most of it did not register. Something told him it did not register with the people he worked with, either.
One thing I do know, Rachel, your father insisted on using Mars as a staging area. Do you remember why?
Earth's magnetic field influences the direction of travel. Yeah, I know.
What makes a magnetic field? John was prompting the president now.
He did not have a clue about this one, but hopefully John could keep ahead.
An electric current passing through a conductor. We've figured out how we screwed up, Mr. President.
Rachel was losing her cool.
Explain it to me then, Rachel, so everyone here in this room gets it too.
An electric current moving along a conductor, like a copper wire, will create a magnetic field that is at right angles to the current flow.
And right now, the Hijastro is sitting in an electric current, a Birkeland current, is that right?
Yes, Mr. President. That is about right. No matter what they do, they go in the wrong direction, because the ship's hull and internal structures are creating a magnetic field perpendicular to the current. No matter how they turn, the plasmoid confinement field is overcome by the larger field created by the ship. That's why they're stuck. That's why I need Dad. We don't know what to do.
One moment, Rachel. The president had fixed his gaze upon West, who was standing next to the diagram on the board.
He's a cold fish, thought the VP as she took in the proceedings. John's expression hasn't changed a bit since learning one of his daughters is stranded, almost as if he's insisting that we figure it out for ourselves.
Trent Bishop noticed this too. He had also spent enough time around the guy to know that John West would move heaven and earth to save his daughters from danger. Why is this so different? Why isn't he speaking up or offering suggestions or doing something other than standing there like a high school teacher waiting for someone to raise her hand with an answer? Trent pondered this thought as he studied the man standing there. What kind of rescue plan have you enacted thus far? The president inquired.
We don't have a rescue plan. That's our only Step 3 ship, and they are way too far away for a Step 2 ship, which is all we have left.
Are they on Step listening to this conversation?
No,
Rachel said forcefully.
I told them to communicate once an hour so they don't move farther away. They should be back up in about 10 minutes. Please find my dad, Mr. President.
Working on it, came the reply. A stern look cast in John's direction did nothing. He just stood there, arms crossed, waiting. Susan Capshaw was reviewing all she had seen and heard, and knew that something was not right. West had the answer, or so it seemed, but he was not sharing.
What is it with this guy and secrets? She thought to herself,
which sparked a renewed anger inside of her.
There is no way he is getting anything from me. Give me a new reactor for a new ship. Well, buddy, you have one ship stuck and another with a reactor you haven't even tried.
The sub,
she blurted out, looking over at John. She realized that she had struck upon the answer he was waiting for.
Rachel, can't you use a sub to effect a rescue?
That ship is still being built. It's not ready to fly.
Are you sure? Susan Capshaw prodded.
Rachel Archives. Lewis Brown was firmly ensconced in his role as the chief engineer for the sub. He had studied electrical engineering in London, then minored in electrical engineering in his home country of Kenya. His passion for plasma physics is what got him his internship with the Sapphire Group. This, in turn, introduced him to the Corps, and then his posting on Mars, helping to construct the greatest ship in the universe, at least in his mind. First the call from Rachel, then all hell broke loose.
Lewis, it's Rachel.
Hello, Rachel. How are you?
You're about to find out, she thought to herself.
Lewis, if we had to use the sub as an emergency rescue vessel, how long would it take to get ready to launch to Deimos for fuel?
Her voice sounded skeptical about even asking such an idiotic question.
Worst case or best case scenario?
Worst case, she managed to get out. Fear was in her voice, knowing the answer already.
Stand by.
Then, in the background, she could hear him asking,
Manny, how long will it take to bring the reactor up to full?
Okay, thank you.
Rachel, the reactor can be ready to go in 18 minutes. The ship can be made ready to perhaps a half hour. The booster rockets are ready now. If there is a crew on the ship, we can walk it in 30 minutes to ensure things are stowed. And once that is complete, we can launch. Though I wouldn't recommend doing it like that.
Rachel was floored.
What about best case?
She asked incredulously.
2 or 3 hours would be a safe time frame, Lewis shot back, hoping. Okay, Lewis. Sarah and the gang are stranded in interstellar space, beyond our solar system, and they need our help. That ship is the only thing that we have that can do the job, so we need to get it up, fueled, and on its way to them.
And they did that with the Hedge Astro, I take it. That's why they are stuck? The question was more for him than anything.
Yes,
came the reply. Rachel's voice had suddenly become calm and determined.
One thing you need to know, Rachel. The ship is not going interstellar until certain tests have been performed.
Tess? You just said 2 or 3 hours. What test?
She demanded.
We need to run the Earth's magnetic field tests that are scheduled before I can allow the ship to go interstellar. I had to give your father my word that that would happen, and he threatened me with losing my job if I did not do them first.
Fine. What all does that entail again? She asked pleadingly.
We need to be in Earth's magnetic field to prove that we can navigate properly, on step, while in it.
The testing was meant to cover several solar cycles, including flare-ups, which would dramatically change the currents passing through the Earth as witnessed by the auroras. Testing designed to last days or weeks, depending on the sunspot activity, but in this case, Lewis would take what he got.
How long?
Asked Rachel, with an air of resignation.
A few hours to do it right, but we need permission from Earth to perform the test.
Why?
Rachel inquired.
Because if something goes wrong and we crash on the planet,
the reactor... Okay, I'll make the call, but proceed as if we were given the green light.
Already on it, Lewis shot back.
The audience that made up the people surrounding the President of the United States had not been off the call. They had heard everything said.
Mr. President, said Rachel.
Go ahead, Rachel.
Do we have permission to perform this set of tests?
Stand by. We are reviewing that data now, came his reply.
What data? She asked with surprise in her voice.
Your dad is giving us a tutorial on the magnetic tests now.
Rachel, her father said.
Nice to hear your voice, Dad. Looks like we didn't need you for this catastrophe.
Cute. Are you assembling your team?
I am. I have Marty coming in from a NASA run. Candace is aboard the sub, and it looks like she's preparing a procedure log now. I see that Manny, Lewis, and Cindy are starting to prep the reactor, and I can have the Space Force cadets walking the ship looking for anything that needs to be secured.
Your sister should be coming up in a few. Not long after, Sarah's familiar but distant voice could be heard over the phone call.
Mars Station, are you there?
Go for Mars, Rachel shot back.
Rachel, we have an idea, but you're not going to like it.
You mean I won't like it because it might work?
Wait, what?
Her sister retort threw her for a second.
You need to see if the sub, or whatever you call it, can be used to come and get us. It can, and it's being prepped to do just that. We have a clock running now. 2 hours, 49 minutes, and 19 seconds until launch. Sound good?
Okay, Rachel, that sounds really good.
Several thighs were heard in the distant background.
Does Dad know yet?
Dad knows, Mom doesn't.
Dead silence followed.
Tell Dad thanks,
Sarah finally said.
It was the Vice President who came up with the idea.
Okay, well, thank her for me.
I think you just did. They're all listening.
Great,
the forlorn voice was heard saying from the depths of space.
Sarah, it's the President.
Hello, Mr. President. Sorry about this.
You keep us on our toes, I'll give you that. Your transmission is very weak. Why is that?
We went out too far. When we tried to shorten the distance for better reception, that's when we noticed the problem.
Well, it's a good thing you stopped when you did. It really would have been upsetting if we had lost comms altogether.
Yes, sir.
Sarah, her father said.
Hi, Dad.
How much are you drifting on step?
About a fifth of an AU.
Just after 10 minutes. It's a lot.
Well, I would suggest you wait for 3 hours to get your next update. No point moving any farther than necessary, okay?
Sounds good, Dad. And thanks.
I'm just glad you're safe.
Sarah, transmit your status before dropping out, Rachel emphasized.
Okay, I'll talk to you in 3 hours. Bye.
And she was gone. 2.5 hours later, the ship was ready for launch. 4 solid fuel rockets would provide the initial acceleration and then fall away. It was the first time this procedure was used, and the first time there were going to be people experiencing it personally. Rachel had made the conference room aboard the sub her new office, which was a small cupboard with a table that had 6 chairs bolted to the floor. The floor itself, along with the rest of the ship's floors, were designed to support the weight during acceleration, which was going to be most of the time. Built around gimbals, the floor orientated to best suit the gravity or acceleration. Because of the ship's design,
It could either be going forward or backward. There was a thrust drive on both ends of the tube, so allowances were made during construction to take this into account. Windows existed, but they were seldom used. Everything the operator needed to see was piped into the consoles, and view screens attached to the gimbaled floors. It was a strange configuration, but as the slip rings were designed and built, moving data to the right location was straightforward. Once Marty arrived at the ship, he was brought up to speed, and Rachel turned command over to him. She had no illusions about her ability to successfully effect a rescue, but she planned on being there when it happened. There were other tasks that needed her attention, so having Marty in charge of the ship freed her up for more immediate issues on Mars, the moon, and the bridge. Marty's second was a young woman from Texas named Candace Stewart, who liked to be called Candy. She was a pretty, soft-spoken woman with large brown eyes that, depending on their size, reflected her mood. An electrical engineer, she had signed up with one of NASA's missions to the moon, but whose talents were soon realized by John's group, and she was recruited to fly long-haul freighter runs to Mars and back. She was on Mars basically waiting for a group of scientists to complete a geological study in the northern hemisphere. Taking control of this beast was not something she had in mind when she woke up, but there was one thing that she was not, is bashful. Then there were the cadets, a total of 5 young recruits from the Space Force that had been selected and allowed a 2-week excursion, first on the moon, and then time on Mars. Marty had seen to it that if people were going to join the force, then they were going to spend time in space. The idea of bringing them along on this mission was their own idea, however. From the first day, the group of cadets had insisted that Rachel be given an honored guard attachment. This meant one of the cadets would shadow Rachel, smartly dressed and basically to be at her beck and call. They would stand at attention out of her way, but ready to jump if she called on them. Rachel was not at all prepared for this at first. She had a hard time not noticing. In no time, though, she found having them around was pleasant, if only for the show. The attire looked sharp, and the young recruits were eager to please, even if that meant staying out of the way. Staying out of the way usually meant they were in the sub, at the secondary control stations practicing navigation and piloting skills. Paige and Trevor had spent time constructing a series of exercises designed to hone the skills of the people meant to operate the ship. These controls would not actually have a purpose unless the primaries were damaged somehow, but everything on the ship had a backup except for the reactor. This secondary control area gave them a place to be and something to do. So when the call was made for unauthorized personnel to leave the ship, Rachel heard a knock on the conference room door and Sean Gray stuck his head in.
"Sean, what can I do for you?"
Rachel asked, then absentmindedly returned to the digital pad in front of her.
"Ma'am, if it wouldn't be too much of an inconvenience, we cadets request permission to accompany you on this flight."
She looked at him thoughtfully. She could see that he was desperate for her to say yes.
"Let me think about it. And Sean, please send word for the lieutenant to join me here in the conference room. Thanks."
A light knock on the door a few moments later, and it was open to allow Marty entrance. The door then closed, with Sean waiting anxiously on the other side.
"What's up?" Marty asked.
"What's our status?"
"Reactor's optimal. Lewis informs me that the thruster is hot. We have plenty of fuel to make it to Deimos. The ship itself is secure. We have air and food for 2 weeks, if necessary, and the fuel we should take on should mimic that. The solid fuel rockets have been checked and rechecked. Hold downs have been checked, too. We should be ready to go. Just waiting for personnel to leave, the ship to be buttoned up and the pad cleared for departure. Once that's done, we can rotate the ship into the upright posture for launch."
"Who's your navigator?" Rachel asked.
"Well, I figure I can handle that. Candy has a pilot seat, so we should be in good shape. As you know, we do not have anyone else here who is a qualified navigator, so I'll handle it."
"Marty, you're in command of this ship. It is the first time to ever be used, and I would feel a lot better with you not having to worry about housekeeping tasks. It seems to me you have 5 qualified navigators on the ship right now who want to help. The 2 people in the room knew that every word that was spoken made it into the hallway. As he stood at attention, the cadet hoped that the lieutenant would agree with her assessment.
Okay, sounds good, came Marty's only response.
Sean, come in here, please.
Rachel raised her voice only slightly.
The door opened and a highly polished young gentleman stepped into the room.
Yes, ma'am,
he said, standing at attention.
Please inform the rest of the cadets that if they so choose, they are welcome to accompany us on this rescue mission. Anyone not coming along needs to vacate the ship immediately. Is that understood?
Yes, ma'am, Sean said with a smile.
Cadet, Marty called out.
Yes, sir,
came the instant reply to Marty's bark.
I'm assuming that all of you want to stay. Is that correct?
Yes, sir,
Sean said in a clear voice.
Is your gear all stowed?
Yes, sir.
Our suits are in the locker aft engineering.
Fine. Pass the word for Talbert and Franz to report to the bridge.
Understood.
Then get yourself and the rest of your squad to acceleration chairs and get ready for the ride of your life.
Understood, sir. Thank you both, he said, grinning as he left the room.
White House Papers.
Lizza Pollard found herself confronted by a slew of reporters as she took to the podium. As press secretary, she had known many in the audience for a long time, and they had gotten along, but there were moments when she just wanted to throw up her hands and walk out for good. She learned early on, the spotlight wasn't all it was cracked up to be. Today was no different. The reports of a flurry of activity around the new ship being built by West indicated that it was getting ready to launch. If that was the case, a severe change had taken place to the original timetable.
Why was having live video feed from the surface of Mars a thing anyway? Oh, that's right. I insisted on it. What an idiot, she thought to herself. If someone flushes a toilet on Mars, somewhere, someone is going to write about it, which means that someone is going to ask me about the event.
She wanted to glare at the sea of reporters in the room as her thoughts wandered.
We understand that the water in the toilet spins in the wrong direction. Care to respond to the allegation?
As everyone got seated, Lizza made an announcement.
The president is going to address you in a few moments. He will not be taking questions at this time, though I will be happy to supply any additional information that I might have at my disposal. But seeing as this is a fluid situation, I doubt that my input will have much relevance.
Just then, everyone stood as the president entered the room. He offered greetings to everyone and singled out several individuals for small jabs. His time as president was quickly waning, and some things about the office he was certainly going to miss. This was one of them. He enjoyed being the leader of the free world and having to explain his position to the people in this room, and many more just like them. For the most part, the press had treated him fairly, unlike their treatment of some former presidents. Trent Bishop took a sheet of paper from his pocket and squared it on the lectern. There was not much to what he was about to say, but a chunk of it was borrowed from the Kennedy speech at Rice University, where he had rededicated the U.S. to go to the moon.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Those words still sent chills up his spine, and he had not even been born when they were spoken. It was a speech that Trent Bishop had practiced many times in front of the mirror to mimic, not only the words, but the cadence. In Trent's opinion, it was the best presidential speech of all time, and now he was going to borrow from it. And that was fine with him. He took a sip of water, cleared his throat, and began.
Earlier, we received word from Mars that the Step 3 ship Hijastro and its 4 passengers, Sarah West, Paige Rowland, Shannon Beale, and Trevor Noah, are stranded approximately 300 times as far away from the sun as the Earth. He paused for effect. They are a long way from home,
and outside our solar system. Their ship is not broken, but the space they are in will not allow the Hegestra to operate properly. The ship and crew are stuck, and without help, they can't make it back. He did not have to feign concern. It showed on his face. There is hope, however. As most of you are aware, the new vessel under construction on the surface of Mars is being readied to deploy and attempt a rescue. For the most part, it is a fully functioning vessel with all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communication, food, and survival. There are a lot of things that need to happen in the right order for this to be a success, but if recent history has shown us anything, there is some very solid bedrock on which to anchor those hopes, he said, followed by a slight pause. The ship will be pivoted from the current horizontal position to the vertical using the gimbaled support, then launched to an elevation of 3,500 feet above the surface where the boosters will drop away. At this point, the step drive and thrust unit will move her to the first of three vector velocity maneuvers prior to translating to Deimos for fuel. Once fueled, the ship will be brought to Earth where several tests will be run to ensure that the vessel will not suffer the same fate as the Hegestra. If everything goes to plan, the rendezvous will take place approximately 32 hours from now. Trent had not looked at the notes in front of him yet. Why bother now? He thought to himself as he continued. I hearken back to a previous president's speech where he outlined the difficulties that were going to be faced getting to the moon inside of a decade. A few of his thoughts and words are worth repeating, he said while examining the numerous faces on the off chance that anyone knew what he was talking about. It appeared that they did, so he continued. Space is an unforgiving place to live and work in. But the benefits are enough to bring together the best and brightest who are willing to risk everything to advance our knowledge of this vast ocean of unknowns. There will be tragedies, and there will be setbacks. But if there are the people with the spirit and strength to set aside their fears to step into the unknown, then great gains are there to be made for all of us. And with the successful launch of this vessel, the intended purpose will soon begin to be realized as it lays the foundations for our exploration of our nearest stars. Trent stole a quick look at his watch. The time of launch was known, and he did not want to be here when it happened. Looking over the solemn faces of his audience, the only words he could think to say flowed from him in earnest. In just a few minutes, from the control center on Mars, a ship with 10 brave souls aboard will be launched. The ship is more than 150 feet tall, made up of new technologies, some having only just been invented, on a voyage to a distant and unknown area of space. And therefore, as they set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.
Hegestra Chronicles.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner,
was Trevor's only comment after the latest radio update. The successful launch resulted in a resupply from the Moon Transfer Station. Then reliable data indicated that the step test for the ship in Earth's orbit was good. This advanced the testing onto Jupiter. John was not taking any chances, and everyone on the Hegestra knew it. If this final, hardcore test worked, they would be rescued. If they failed to produce the results everyone hoped for, then this would be their coffin.
That sounds really good right now, Paige said in a high spirit. You watch. They'll be here in two shakes.
Trevor's optimism was winning out, as the news brought solace to all.
I mean the chicken dinner, Paige corrected him. Oh, yeah.
Trevor's stomach started to growl as he wondered what they had that was good to eat. Now he had time to think about it. The mood on the Hegestra had improved significantly since the realization of their predicament.
So many different things were tried, and none of them worked. Trevor kept thinking about the step relay and how it was nearly the end of all of them. Such a small detail. A status light indicating that the unit still had a connection. Unbelievable, everyone thought as they continued farther and farther away from home. The calls back to Mars were getting worse. In fact, bad, but everyone was curious, not just Trevor. How far could this little beacon reach? Then came the last transmissions, the plotting of the return path, and the sinking feeling everyone felt when the vessel did not move along the intended path, but kept moving in one direction, the wrong direction. But the relay, why was the status light still indicating a connection? It was not until the unit was powered off that the truth was revealed. It had lost lock on the Mars Step Relay module and resynced itself to the radio in the Hijastro. Had they just killed themselves? Everyone thought so. The saving grace was that shutting down the relay, the radio was not trained to use a relay to communicate and did all the work itself. It being a much more powerful system proved still in range to make contact, but only just. Trevor had been the main cheerleader, and he took it upon himself that he was responsible for their predicament. Everyone thought this was ludicrous for the simple fact that they were not supposed to have gone anywhere near this far in this ship. John had made it abundantly clear that no ship goes interstellar without his permission.
"Well, he's on vacation, isn't he?"
Sarah could still hear the words leave her mouth as she convinced Rachel of the merits of the experiment.
"We can't leave everything up to him. One day it's just going to be you and me, Rachel."
Rachel had relented, and here we are, Sarah told herself. Paige had a smile on her face that came and went. Came and went. She was having a hard time controlling her enthusiasm. If they made it back, and it looked like they would, she was going to earn her $3 million. She had seen the Holy Grail, the spare step drive that they had opened and promptly destroyed while trying to fix the ship. It had been a wasted effort, except for the fact that Paige's custom CIA glasses had recorded it all. She had evidence that the inside of the drive looked exactly like the contents of the 5 storage crates she had moved to Mars Station several months earlier. The stencil on the outside of the 5 containers read, "Distortion Field Generator." She had stolen a quick peek during the transit, and sure enough, they looked exactly like the glass protrusions surrounded by an insulating material that this spare step drive had. Shannon's sleeve had gotten snagged on one such protrusion, and when she tried to pull free, the glass broke, and the whole thing exploded with a resounding crash. The shattered remnants were inside the protective material, but everyone knew it had destroyed itself. Sarah mentioned that she got to hear 2 of them break at the same time.
"Startled the hell out of me."
Paige had been approached not only by the DOD director, but by Vice President Capshaw. They convinced her that a life in space was no place for an intelligent person such as herself. They explained that she had a place in the new administration, but she had to earn that place. The plan was simple. Get control of a step ship and return it to Earth, or find evidence of the parts that make up the drive, locate the equipment, and as much source material as possible. Once identified, a plan would be set in motion that would involve getting a unique group of cadets to Mars to steal the parts, then load them on a ship and make a break for home. The planning would have to be meticulous, but there was no reason it could not come together if the time were right. Paige's report back to her boss, showing the crates containing the distortion field generators, until now, was an unknown distraction. It was likely that West had developed them, but they did not suit his needs. That probably happened a lot at first, she convinced herself. He may be holding on to these for sentimental reasons. They were there for the taking, and she had proof they were used at the heart of the drives. If we can just get rescued, she thought to herself, a smile threatening to surface again. Sarah gave out a deep yawn as the day's events began to overwhelm her.
Go get some sleep, Shannon suggested.
I'm going to be working on this for hours, she confessed.
Sarah relented and made her way back to the storage area where the nets were available to secure tired passengers. Trevor had rotated the ship to look at the vista that was the center of the Milky Way. "Beautiful," he said again. "Well, there's no denying it. He's using the right word," Paige thought, just as Shannon giggled, once again, at the work she had been doing. Paige went over to investigate. "That's the third time. What's so funny?" Paige looked down at the tablet Shannon was working on. It was filled with a series of math formulae, which meant nothing to her. Though she did have a background in mathematics, the formula looked nothing like any of the obvious ones she had worked with during her time in college. And then there were those glasses she wore when she used the pad. "I'm just trying to improve the avoidance software, and I think I'm making progress," she lied. "Seems to me like it's working good now," Trevor complimented. "Thanks, but it's not there yet." "What about those glasses? Is that a link of some kind?" Paige inquired, taking several pics of Shannon's formulas at the same time. Shannon glanced up at Paige, who was trying to get a better look at her work. "I have a condition. I can't see letters well on this type of display in low-light conditions," she lied again, holding up the pad. "Thus, the lighted specs help me see." "Oh, I didn't know that," Paige said. "Yeah, neither did I," Trevor conceded. "I can brighten it up in here if you need." "I'm fine. Continue your stargazing," Shannon smiled. "No, I think I'm going to turn in too," he decided. "It's been a long day. You're up for a while?" he asked. "Yep, I'll take the first shift," she announced. Paige stayed with her for another half hour, but there was not much to do. The next radio check was over 2 hours away, and she had to admit, a little sleep right now sounded surprisingly good. She bid farewell to her shipmate and headed to the back. Shannon had been using the Tilt 5 holographic projector glasses for years. The four black dots around the edge of the pad's display was how the glasses orientated themselves. The thin sheet of film protecting the pad's display was a perfect reflector for the light being emitted by the glasses she wore. The effect was a three-dimensional, holographic display whenever she was looking at the pad. Currently, the hologram she was manipulating had all the working parts in place. The one thing missing was John's carefully constructed glass protection found in all his drives. "But this isn't his drive, it's mine," she thought to herself with satisfaction. She wondered if she could build it on her own. "No, John knows all about how best to make these drives work, and if not him, who?" She knew that constructing the Step 4 drive was truthfully beyond her ability, and to bring someone else in would just not be right. It was not a surprise to her that John was stuck on Step 3. The idea that he was able to figure any of this out on his own, then build it, was a testament to his ability. She, on the other hand, was his go-to girl, so she had seen much more than anyone else, and the math model she developed for the compression coils had given her a path to follow. If she were right, once Step 4 was achieved, there was no point in developing Step 5. Might as well go right on to Step 6 and get it over with. But that again was going to require a leap forward in ship and power design. It was going to take an exceptionally large bump of energy to get to Step 6, but not much harder to hold than Step 4 she was designing now. "My God," she thought, "this could be built before the sub is even fully constructed. John is going to freak." Hijastro Chronicles.
"Boy, and Bob's your uncle."
Stating the obvious, Trevor powered on the beacon. Keying up the radio, he said,
"You took your sweet time getting here."
Rachel's voice came back over on the speaker. "Just here for the step relay you have."
"It's safely tucked away. You want it, you have to take the whole package."
"Okay, Trevor," Rachel grinned to herself. "Did you want to just come to us?" she asked.
"Sure. Firing up the thrusters now. Be there in 2 shakes.
It was a nice reunion, and with the news passed along, a collective sigh was heard throughout the solar system.
General Smith was now in the habit of regularly talking with his son, whom Rachel had placed in charge of the mission. "What's that alarm, Marty?" he asked with a hint of concern. "Yeah." Marty glanced over the readings before answering. Once the doors are closed, the ship looks at itself. It sees a stable magnetic presence that was not there before. The alarm is indicating that the storage room needs to be degaussed.
Degaussed? What's that? Asked Susan Capshaw.
The Hijastro is magnetized, ma'am. We need to demagnetize it before we leave the area.
What's that going to set you back, Marty? The general inquired.
About an hour, if I read this right, yeah. Yeah, an hour.
Then what's your plan? His father asked.
Back to Mars. Should be there in 4 hours or so.
Wes just handed me the ship's manifest to look over, and I'm guessing there is a reason. Looks like you guys are stocked up, the general noted.
Yes, sir. We could stay out for weeks if necessary.
But didn't you pick up several more of those relays when you got those supplies from the moon?
Yes, sir.
Well, put your big boy pants on and go deploy them, he said in a stern voice. A loud round of laughter could be heard from somewhere as Rachel's voice coughed out, "Big boy pants!"
I thought you were in command of that ship, General Smith pushed.
Nice try, Dad, Marty mumbled, his face beet red at this point. Sarah spoke up.
We'll review your request and make our decision, General.
John could not help himself.
Very well worded, Sarah. Taking lessons?
How's the vacation? She asked.
A little more excitement than I had planned on.
Your father is trying to get us to sell him another reactor, the president managed.
Not the 110 kilowatt, John. It needs to be a minimum of 180.
Shannon threw out without thinking.
What the hell does that mean? John asked after a moment.
Shannon suddenly felt trapped.
And then there were two,
Maggie Jones realized aloud. She had come in to quash this little get-together. In her mind, the president had more important things to do and places to be. All eyes in the conference room had turned to look at her as she studied Shannon's embarrassed face on the monitor.
Before the meeting broke up with the possibility of a signed deal, Rachel confirmed that her father was truly on vacation.
I'm getting a thumbs up from your dad, the president acknowledged.
Well, I thought of a name for the ship, and Sarah likes it, so I just wanted to make it official, is all.
Mr. President, if I may have a word, John tried to interject, but the president held up his hand, indicating he did not like to be interrupted.
I'm sorry, Rachel. You were saying that you have a name for the ship?
Mr. President, John nearly shouted his annoyance.
Well, 1 second, Rachel, the president said before calling on his security detail.
Motioning towards John with a slightly amused look, he spoke once more.
Please escort this inconsiderate gentleman out of the room. I'm trying to have a conversation here.
John stood there fuming as the two Secret Service agents, barring the door in front of him, obviously could not help themselves.
Stepping stone, the first agent said.
His face showed no emotion as he stared straight at John.
Stepwife?
No, I don't think you can have one of those, the second man countered.
Step-X, the first shot back. That might work.
Lewis Brown already had a look at the insulation tiles that had been transferred from orbit. These tiles were the secret ingredient that the ship needed to disrupt external influences, allowing the generated magnetic field to point in the direction they wanted it to. This tile set had been manufactured for the Hijastro, but it was never sent to Mars. The company was waiting for payment, which John gladly delivered on. Then it was just a matter of getting them to the sub before it departed on the rescue mission. Using the provided stencil, and with the aid of the crew, Lewis was able to install the tiles on the small ship. Then it was a simple matter to relaunch the Hijastro and perform some test flights.
Seems fine, Sarah thought.
See you in a few, she said
into the mic, as she and the crew of the Hijastro set off to accomplish the tasks that got them in trouble in the first place.
the newly named ship, having already been given the nickname BJ, turned and headed deeper into the void. They would move to a point that would probably be a step relay location and wait there. Wait for Sarah and her team to get the first one in a good location. The BJ sat on station and provided the Hijastro with the third relay and a top-up of fuel. After which, the little craft made its way to the next point, set up the relay, and performed the necessary tests. Returning, Hijastro was loaded back into the cargo hold, and the BJ set out on the return trip to Earth, her mission accomplished.
"Why Big John?" the question came out from one of the many reporters present. "Is it a homage to their father?"
"My understanding," explained Lisa Pollard, "is that Rachel was listening to the recorded music on the ship, and a song with a similar name started playing. Rachel said that at first she thought the song a bit corny, until it reached the third stanza. That stanza is what caused her to think the name of the song fit the name of the ship."
"Have you heard the song yourself, Mrs. Pollard?" The follow-up question set several heads to nodding.
"I have not. But I'm sure by the end of the day we will all know it and the reason behind the girls settling on the name."
John turned off the TV. "Could be worse. They could have actually named it Blowjob," he conceded. "So, Shannon is no longer the student, but the master. She seemed confident in the meeting. The VP offering her $1 billion for the design didn't help. Knowing the offers were made in jest, but soon they would be real. This could very well be the end of Western Wave. Deeper pockets combined with a step four? We can't match that. Maybe it would not be so bad. I could retire. The girls are well off. I made sure of that. Neither one of them have had much opportunity to spend any of their own money. Yeah, maybe this would be a good time to retire. Sit back and see what happens," he thought. Easing himself deeper into the recliner, John promptly fell asleep. Beale interview. As soon as Rachel made it back to Mars and the congratulations doled out, she began a significant alteration to the work schedule. With Shannon's avoidance software successfully tested, the Hijastro was promptly rated for Step 3 service. Until such time the BJ could deploy more relays, it was hauling paying customers.
"They can finish construction on the move," Rachel thought to herself.
Shannon had concerns about her relationship with John. He had not said anything that would make her uncomfortable, but she knew that he was worried.
"John, how do you feel about Vlad helping me bring this drive to life?" she asked hesitantly.
"You can have anyone you like, Shannon. It's your drive."
"You're not mad?" she asked.
"About?"
"About me beating you to the next step. You know very well what I'm talking about."
"Look, Shannon, it's not about beating me. I'm just a little scared, that's all."
"You think I'm going to give it away?"
"Well, if you give it away, you're a fool. The VP already offered you $1 billion. I'd hold out for two."
"That's it. You don't trust me."
She looked genuinely hurt. "Look, I haven't told the girls this yet, but I plan on retiring after this new ship with your new drive gets built. I have no illusions about the probability of this tech getting out in the wild. It's going to happen. You need to get someone to help build not just this drive, but the others that follow. Yes, I trust you. I just don't trust human nature when given unlimited power."
"I promise."
John held up his hand to stop her. "I don't want to hear promises, especially from you. Just do what you feel is the right thing to do. That's all the reassurance I need." White House Papers. Paige had returned as a conquering hero. The meeting she had with the Vice President and the head of the Department of Defense, Marcy Cooper, confirmed to Paige that they agreed with her. She had found the Rosetta Stone. She had identified several step drive units not in use. All the data would be analyzed by some of the best and brightest, and a potential plan would be devised to secure one of those crates on Mars.
"You don't feel she can be persuaded to share her findings?" asked Marcy.
"Shannon? No. She's too loyal to John and his crusade.
Paige hated what she said the moment she said it.
You sound like you are of the same mindset as we are, Paige.
Good. The vice president took on an admiring look.
John's insistence that we are not qualified to understand this work is what has set us on this path of espionage.
Qualified is probably not the right word for his apprehension, Paige corrected. Fear is closer to the truth.
What do you mean?
Miss Capshaw asked quickly.
Well, you have actually talked with West about the reasonings, I take it.
More gleaned from conversations with the president.
Oh,
Paige said in surprise.
You appear better informed. Perhaps you would care to enlighten us.
Susan Capshaw truly was not interested in what the man thought, but she sank back in the sofa, folded her arms, and was at least prepared to listen.
It's pretty straightforward, really, she began. He doesn't want the power of this tech to be used against the Earth. He's afraid that the wrong people will exploit it and do irreversible damage, Paige spoke in earnest. This is your feeling, I take it? Is that right? Marcy spoke up.
No, ma'am.
I have talked with him for hours on the subject, hitting it from every angle I could think of. He is fearful of what it can be made to do.
Well, it's a little late to put that genie back in the bottle, Susan said to herself.
In his mind, getting the development of this tech as far away from Earth is the motivating factor behind his push to leave the system, so it can be studied safely. His passion does have merit.
Yes, yet here you are, helping us acquire the technology. You must not share his belief in humanity's need to destroy itself.
Paige could tell the vice president was set in her desires. John was not going to be the hero, not in her mind.
I aspire, yes. Being a glorified pilot for the rest of my life is not one of my goals. The work we have done has been great, wonderful in fact, but I want my time and talents spent here on the ground. I also enjoy the idea of sitting here conversing with two of the most powerful people in the world. That appeals to me. So although I do not share John West's vision, I can't help but recognize his concern.
Well, Miss Rowland, I can assure you that we value your contributions. I can also assure you that when this is over, we will be needing a director to head up the Blue Ribbon Committee that will be assigning workloads for the new space program. And I think you would be my choice. I also feel that your contribution to date is certainly worth 1/3 of the agreed amount we discussed. What do you think?
The directorship would be a challenge I would take to heart. However, I do believe the amount discussed was for a proof of a drive unit that we could obtain. Is there something I missed?
Paige asked disappointedly.
You have brought us evidence, not proof. But if we do get our hands on one of those devices, you will immediately receive the balance. That I can guarantee.
The vice president promised while rubbing her hands together at the thought.